I need to say it again. I have no relationships to disclose except with my partner, I guess. I don't think they mean that, though. So let me begin here with a quote. The government's policy regarding the immigrant has been negative, concerned with exclusion and deportation, with the head tax and the enforcement of treaties and international agreements. Sounds like something written recently. No, Lillian Wald in 1915 from Henry Street, the house on Henry Street. So the two prior presentations have presented an overview of the history of migration and the language used to talk about immigrants. In particular, the discourse used to characterize immigrants in the nursing literature, as well as the presence or absence of policies and position statements on immigrants, immigrant policy, and immigrant health in major professional nursing organizations. As both presentations have pointed out, immigrants are simultaneously visible and invisible, both within the nation at large and within nursing. So they are visible when they cross U.S. borders, when you hear of INS workplace raids, when they are screened for diseases, and when you talk about laws related to English as a second language. But they become invisible when we look at them in terms of their contributions to the economy and in their struggles with living in substandard conditions, or when they have healthcare needs that ought to be addressed. And I want to remind you of the case earlier this year in which the immigrant woman was in the ER for 24 hours and subsequently died. How was that woman invisible for that long? So I'd like to spend some time talking about some particular aspects of immigration and health, theoretical perspectives about the invisibility of immigrants, and what actions we can take to address these issues. So Lillian Wald is the one person we, at least in our discipline, we tend to look back to for inspiration. And her, as Sharon pointed out, her perspective is particularly important even today, as much if not most of her work was with immigrant populations of New York City. But even in 1915, Lillian Wald often talked about the animosity, fear, contempt for immigrants that was going on in her city, and that was nothing new, that in fact that each country, new group entering, was considered a threat by the group that was already there. But Wald argued that rather than being the threat from the new groups entering the country, it was the majority population that constituted the danger to newly arrived immigrants, commenting that the East Side, the melting pot, is less perilous to New York than New York is to the East Side. So although Wald was writing nearly a century ago, clearly what is old is new again. So there's no question that immigrants come to the U.S. with a host of health conditions as a result of the circumstances of the originating environment, poverty, malnutrition. We all know these things. And thousands often arrive with undiagnosed and or untreated diseases and illnesses, while circumstances and limited resources often then leave them continuing to live in substandard conditions, which fail to ameliorate and, in fact, may worsen their health status. So the literature is replete with studies noting that access to healthcare is limited by language barriers, health insurance, ability to pay, a confusing and often dehumanizing, disrespectful, and even racist healthcare system, and for those here without U.S.-required documentation, the fear of detection by immigration authorities. So although undocumented immigrants' use of ED services adds to uncompensated care costs, it is not a primary factor in rising costs, but rather a symptom of little or no access to primary care. So I don't want to dismiss the health issues that many immigrants face, but I also don't want to demonize nor stereotype this group as one that is replete with infections and illnesses, and therefore defective and without merit. As being portrayed this way then reinforces unfounded fear and cultivates bias, resulting in the unjust and undignified way in which immigrants are treated. So as an example, this is reported by the Associated Press in July of 2008 about a pregnant undocumented woman who was shackled to a hospital bed during labor after being arrested for driving without a license. So she was handcuffed to the bed by her right wrist and left ankle until shortly before birth. Apparently there's some discrepancy about how long she was left unshackled, but apparently the accounts agree that the mother had a guard with her at all times. The attending nurses requested that the cusp be removed, but the guards refused, and the reason that she was required to be shackled was that she was a medium security risk since she had been previously deported. I don't think this is dignified and a just way to treat someone. So a common aspect of the discourse around immigrants is the language of threat. So immigrants constitute a range of threats from disease to national security. The idea of threat means that protective actions need to be taken to keep us safe. So this form of othering promotes activities such as wall building, disease screening, defending borders, and guarding against contact. So I wanted to share three more examples in which immigrants have been perceived to constitute a threat, and from two perspectives, one from this idea of health and illness, and one from in terms of finances and economics. In the end, the immigrant, seen as constituting a threat to the nation, ends up losing out in terms of human rights and human dignity. It is important to note that there is often little concern about the problems that the immigrant, him or herself, may have with a particular disease or illness. Rather, it is the disease that is constructed as the risk that is posed to others. So as such, immigrants are screened and quarantined to control the spread of disease. So in July of 2008, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services announced new requirements, among which are 5 new vaccinations for individuals requesting to become legal permanent residents. And one of the new requirements is the human papillomavirus vaccine. So adding this requirement is based on creating an image of female immigrants as sexualized and promiscuous and a threat to U.S. population. So while girls and women who are U.S. citizens have a choice about whether or not to take Gardasil, anyone wishing to become a legal permanent resident has no choice in the matter, regardless of the risk or their personal feelings about the vaccine, and then it actually does nothing to how you address what about those who already have HPV. The other category of threat is in terms of economics. So immigrants are seen as a threat to the availability of jobs for recognized citizens, and as a threat to the viability of the U.S. economy and various business entities, including healthcare organizations. So we have a case where the federal government in 2000 told New York State health officials that chemotherapy, which had been covered for undocumented immigrants under a program for emergency medical care, does not qualify for coverage. New York State defines emergency as conditions that could become an emergency or could lead to death without treatment. So one of the New York officials was quoted as saying, "To say that the immigrants don't qualify as self-defeating, as those situations will eventually become emergencies." Although a limited provision in Medicaid permits emergency coverage for, quote, non-citizens, the program has been closely monitored by the current administration in efforts to deny state claims for federal payments, such that from 2001 to 2006, $11 million in matching funds for Medicaid were denied for chemotherapy. The other case was, this is from the New York Times in August of this year, about hospitals deporting immigrants back to their countries of origin. And the if you didn't read the article, it's quite interesting. They gave an example of a 35-year-old undocumented immigrant who suffered severe brain injury after being hit by a drunk driver in Florida. The hospital spent $1.5 million on his care and then leased an air ambulance and had him sent back to Guatemala, where currently he is confined to a bed in his 72-year-old mother's house. He was taken home by the family after being found lying in his own excrement in a Guatemalan hospital, so he no longer receives medical care or medicine and now has routine violent seizures. So you can see the adage about a sight out of mind operating here, so once you get the patient off the plane and into whatever country, you don't have to think about the consequences of that anymore. So though immigrants can be seen as needy, helpless, and a drain on resources, in reality, there are two types of immigrants that reside in the collective imagination in the U.S. One is the brown-skinned, law-breaking, disease-carrying, desperate individual, and the other is a skilled immigrant that we actively recruit to fill needy occupational positions. Only the second is seen as having abilities and as contributors to the greater society. These types of metaphors contribute to a feeling of not just us and them, but us against them. In effect, we screen immigrants for desired factors such as education and skills, and we screen out others in terms of criminality, disease, those sorts of things. And in so doing, health then acts as a means of social control. When seen as a threat in terms of our national security, including being free from the threat of disease, when seen as not one of us, when seen as not having any legitimate claim to normal entitlements, then anything and everything is possible, and immigrants, to quote the New York Times, are subject to whatever abusive regimes the powers of the moment may devise, including detention and deportation to those who we decide are undocumented. From Lillian Wald again, it is my belief that we in the United States have been doing just exactly that which we pretend not to do, what we have solemnly declared we shall never do. We have denied to many very worthy human beings that dignity which, according to the theory on which our government was founded, should be accorded to every human being. So if one believes that there is something unjust about immigrants, undocumented or not, are being how they're being treated in the U.S., then what can be done? So in this final section, I want to talk about the role of social justice in public health, followed by a discussion or a suggestion for reframing the philosophical approach dominating public health, and finally a list of actions that we as individuals can take to respond to these issues. As Gostin and Powers have claimed, justice is viewed as so central to the mission of public health that it has been described as the field's core value. A focus on social justice then encourages the development of social policies that strive to improve health and keep the needs of the most vulnerable in mind. Despite this core value, utilitarianism has been substituted for the principle of justice in many approaches taken to public health issues. So public health in the U.S. was founded on and continues to operate on the principle of utilitarianism. That is, generally speaking, the greatest good for the greatest number. So, for example, policies have been set in place that allow for the quarantine of infectious individuals to prevent spread of disease to others. From maternal child care to polio prevention, the magnitude of the population reach serves as one measure of intervention success and efficacy. In this instance, the rights of the individual are outweighed by what is seen as the need for protecting the larger society. We raise the question of whether, in fact, this principle ought to be the guiding principle for today's public health. Utilitarianism, in effect, privileges the majority. It privileges those who are already at an advantage compared to others in society. Of the privileged majority, those individuals need to be recognized citizens in order to be eligible for the health services we want to provide. So, which leads us back in trying to figure out how you keep justice as the focus of public health. So justice, and this is from the OED, the Oxford, thank you. Justice is defined as the quality of being morally just or righteous, which then asks us, what moral obligations do public health practitioners have with respect to the less well-off, in particular, quote, unrecognized populations? This is particularly important as we try to reduce existing health disparities. So Daniels talks about two different means to achieve health for all. One is health maximizers, and the other is health egalitarians. So health maximizers look for achieving the most good commensurate to the resources used, no matter how health is distributed across populations. A maximizing strategy, then, pays little heed to the rank order of need. That is, those in greater or greatest need are given no priority in terms of services rendered. Frohlich and Potvin reviewed the population approach literature and have identified three interventions that increased health disparities using this approach. So the first was cervical cancer screening, in which women with higher incomes were more likely to be screened than women with lower incomes. The second was the use of neonatal intensive care, and this is research from Brazil demonstrating again that the intervention primarily reached those from higher socioeconomic standings. And then smoking cessation campaigns again have been shown to be much more effective among those with higher levels of education. On the other hand, the health egalitarian strategy targets the worst off first, followed by the next worst off and down the line. So given society's role in creating the policies and structures that contribute to the inequalities in the first place, I argue that society has a particular obligation to address equity for the least well-off over maximizing the health of aggregates. But I also argue that targeting populations, be if you call them populations at risk, vulnerable populations, whatever term we use, remains problematic, and that perhaps a better strategy would be to focus on issues and the degree of need with respect to an issue, rather than focusing on the population itself. And not to get led astray by focusing on a particular population because that lets us marginalize some groups and privilege others. The question becomes, well, how do you determine who gets priority? And to that, I have no answer. My sort of thinking is, well, if we could make a move to really operationalize and getting us to prioritize about justice, hopefully we work out the details about how one prioritizes, knowing that it's a struggle and that, in fact, these are points about which reasonable people are bound to disagree, and we're going to have to work through those issues. Social justice must be used to combat the idea that the circumstances of our lives do not arise, nor can they be solely solved through personal actions. In the end, what is called for is an interventionist form of social justice, not one that is passive or relies on the market. And we can see the market isn't working very well today. So in terms of what do we do as individuals, and here I'm reiterating some of the things that Sharon had talked about and where we have tried to go, and with Mary's work, starting and talking about critiquing current policies and systems and how they talk about groups and how they're integrating and using social justice, emailing congressional representatives about your experience with immigrants, what your views are, asking them what their goals are for national immigration reform. You notice how that's totally gone from the current discussion, and healthcare reform. Work to pass state legislation that provides services for all, regardless of citizenship. Look at your own organizations in terms of policies and its commitment to addressing discrimination across the board. If you, your students, whoever are unfamiliar with the issues around human rights, to sign up for human rights training. Documenting the health consequences of what happens to people who are in detention and what happens when they get deported. Those are nurses on those air ambulances dropping people off in Guatemala. What happens to those people once they get to those countries? Reiterating what Sharon had already talked about, challenging the use of hate speech and the demonizing of immigrant groups, challenging the use of the language of threat, examining the language used in publications regarding immigrants and health. Is the monolithic immigrant evident in our own writing? I think that what I hope that we've brought up in these presentations is that we each have questions in terms of the three areas we care about in nursing: education, research, and practice. So Sharon raises questions about those of us who are educators. How do we think about that when we're teaching? What should we be bringing to the classroom in terms of media advocacy, human rights, those sorts of things? Mary's questions about how do we write about what we do? What's the language that we use in order to describe these groups, in order to get away with this sort of monolithic approach, which is the easy way out? And then for me, the question of when do we focus on immigrants as a vulnerable population? Because I think that idea is an important one and useful. But on the other hand, when do we focus on the issues that happen to occur to people who happen to be immigrants, and therefore they don't get lost in the mix? So I think with that, we're done. I'm not necessarily the moderator here, but if there are questions or comments?
about focusing on the issue as opposed to the immigrants or the group. However, I work in a public health department and in Orange County, and sometimes we're trying to move to a more population-based focus. And sometimes when we see many, many immigrants, sometimes with limited dollars, you know, the nurses that work in the field know where to take and what the programs that are needed. So oftentimes it is immigrants, it's the fact that they're immigrants first, and then the issues that they have related to them that we're looking for, because those are the most vulnerable people. So sometimes you have to focus on first the immigrants and then the issues that come with them. Because we often get, well, why are you focusing on those groups? It's because these are the vulnerable populations. And oftentimes it's very hard to come right out and say, because these are the children that are going to school with your children.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're sick, then your children will be sick. And then the light bulb clicks off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so sometimes it's very hard to not just look at an issue, but to really focus more on the populations. Because that's what we're looking for, is where are those little groups within our communities that need us the most?
And It's a philosophical shift. I mean, because if we think about how long has health disparities been on our target, and have we seen any movement in those gaps? Not. I mean, there was a recent report about a study that looked at narcotics in the ED and looked at between blacks and whites. And even though for pain relief, and even though, so they looked from like the 1980s to 2005 or something like that. So even though nurses and providers are giving more pain medicine, the gap between black and white just did this. It just is this. So we're giving more, but that gap has done nothing. And so the question is, you know, I believe in population stuff, but on the other hand, you know, maybe we just focus on AIDS and who has the most problem with HIV/AIDS, and you still get at that group anyway without focusing on specific groups that, you know, maybe isn't where you ought to focus. I don't know, but it doesn't seem to be working, and it doesn't leave social justice. It's utilitarianism. Who's the most good? So it doesn't, you know, social justice then isn't your driver.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right that when the rubber hits the road, sort of thing, if you're working with immigrants, you're going to have, and you're doing it, you know, effectively, you're going to have staff who speak the correct language and all this kind of stuff. So there needs to be, but I think what you're addressing is more on the level of sort of state policy and federal policy and so on. So ready for next year's engagement, how do you go from the policy sort of conceptualization and so on to the reality of actually delivering the services?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And does a policy exist?
Whatever people are doing becomes kind of like the policy, doesn't it? I mean, it's established by people doing things, not by fiat.
Right. So I guess, the question would be, is there a policy within various organizations to look at, to even see if it's being implemented, or is it like some of these nursing organizations where there is no policy, so it's invisible, so you don't even have anything to guide your practice. You don't have a framework for you to help think about these issues, or to bring back, you know, in your situation with the public health nurses, you know, to have maybe at a staff meeting to have some discussion about the policy. Because there is no policy. I don't know, but maybe that's something to look at within your own organization, how those policies are written.
But how do you, I was very struck by your comments about how, for example, smoking cessation really hit people who have more means and more education and so on. So that has been inadvertent, do you think? I mean, mean, it's sort of like this public health initiative to reduce smoking and put together a program, and the people who are putting the program together are like middle class, and they made it in a way that middle class people would access.
Well, what's the most common intervention that most public health does when they want to do a smoke and get people to quit smoking? What do they all create? They hand out a pamphlet. That's a lot of the programs are, you know, I'm doing education tool, and that's who it ends up targeting to, or that who has the means to pay attention to it, or that's who's, you know. I don't know what happens when the literature says that when we end up, you know, reaching the people who probably don't need to be reached about that. So, I mean, at least when I listen to my students, I mean, and, you know, who are out there in practice, and, you know, they think the public is pretty ignorant, and they, you know, they always want to educate them all and create a pamphlet they want to hand them. It's just, you know, they give the public.
Yeah, I wanted to bring it back to language a little bit.
Yeah.
First, thank you for a very thoughtful and thought-provoking presentation. You brought a lot in this three presentations. But language. So one thing is, in 94, I wrote an article on undocumentedness and sent it off to a nursing journal, and the editor said, "What's that?" She had no idea what it was that I was submitting about. So, I guess, unfortunately, now everybody knows what that document is, you know, because it was gone to the legal. But, you know, Mary, you talked about, you know, foreign nurses. So why are we talking about foreign nurses? What is this language? And one thing that always sort of hit me, because I lived out of the U.S. for a number of years, and none of the Americans living outside called themselves immigrants. We're out of our country. So I think, you know, I think again, why do we call ourselves, you know, how do we call ourselves, what do we call the people who come in, the people who go out, and then why are we talking about foreign nurses? Mm-hmm. You know, what is this, you know, what is foreign about them? So I really think that we have to continue to look at language and, you know, how we're using that and just what that means. And there's a big issue now in the nursing community about letting foreign nurses in, because it's that economic issue. They're taking the jobs.
Or the drain.
Not even talking about the brain drain. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But most of the nurses here are not concerned about the brain drain as much as they are about their own
security. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Hi. I'd like to address a question to all of you, but especially the first speaker. My work takes me to southern states and dealing with mostly Latino immigrants to areas where the communities where they're not used to, they hadn't really had the situation 10, 15 years ago. And what I see is that in the policy debate and the political debate, that the public health sector is very sympathetic, trying to figure out the sorts of things that we're talking about today, but really taking a beating from the extreme positions. Mm-hmm. Even though those are, to a large extent, a minority voice, but they're beating. Mm-hmm. And so the situation really is deteriorating, because the public health sector can't really go to their policymakers, especially their legislators, and say, here's the arguments. They don't have a good set of talking points. And I've been looking for one. I wonder if you can help me out.
Probably some of the resources that are on the slides, which uh-huh. I gave permission to be recorded, et cetera, and I think probably downloadable. But also, I rely a lot on the NAHCLA report, because every once in a while it has an issue entirely devoted to migration, et cetera. But there are also talking points. I mean, you can find them on the internet in terms of dispelling the mythology, and that we keep it concise and succinct.
Right.
And rational, hopefully, because a lot of the talk and the hype is so irrational. But the National Immigration Forum, also, I think, I don't remember if I put it on there, the National Immigration Forum has actually done a lot of research, and it's a very pro-immigrant group, but they have linked up with the conservative Cato Institute in terms of doing the kind of research that actually documents the economic contributions and how many taxes are paid by both documented and undocumented immigrants,
right,
and so on. And so I think that needs to be brought up and maybe, you know, compared. You know, they use $5 billion worth of services, but they pay $137 billion worth of taxes, you know. Because we always think of immigrant workers as people who don't pay taxes. We think they're immigrants, so they don't pay taxes. Well, they do. They're just like everybody else.
Especially in the South, there's no income tax, so every time you buy a loaf of bread, you're taxed.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I'll give you my card and you can be an email to
you. Yeah, and I think what's also important with that whole media literacy is your experiences. So having those talking points, but interspersed with that is your own experience of working with whatever group it is that you work with to humanize the people, because I think that's what Denise is really raising too, is this dehumanization process that goes on. Whereas if you have stories that you can share, whether it's in a media format or it's with your legislator, in addition to those facts, I think that can really bring that message more clearly and really have an impact. Yes?
My comment kind of follows up on what you just were saying, is that, you know, I work in the public health sector in the Deep South, and you can't be radical. I mean, you can't. I mean, calling legislators and calling, you know, public officials doesn't help. And we do have talking points. We have talking points that we, you know, have been given and worked on to call those folks, but it doesn't get anywhere. And the way that I've discovered that you can affect change that hopefully eventually will have an effect is from the bottom up. It's talking to folks, and a little bit contrary to what you were saying at the beginning, I've actually found a lot of folks in the public health sector who are very anti, who are very uncompassionate. Now, working with folks that are on the side of immigrants, you do find folks, you know, in the public health sector who are trying to lead efforts, but you also find a lot of folks who've been in public health for much longer than we've had immigrants, and they're very non-receptive to this change in their public. And so they want public health to be who they've always seen public health to be, whereas now, as of the last 10, 12 years or so, public health has a very different color, language, face, and many people are very, you know, against that change. And but what I have seen to be effective is on a very small scale, working person to person, you know, generating ideas, different ways of looking at things, you know, questions around the language and the things that we say. And some of those small seeds eventually, hopefully, will be able to grow together and create a vine that actually makes a difference from the bottom up. But it's practically impossible to look at policies and stuff when you have, for example, in our state, when you have one of the most stringent anti-immigrant laws in the entire country. So going to the folks and saying, you know, let's create a pro-immigrant, you know, piece of legislation. I mean, it's just...
What I would just like to address on that just for a minute is our own history as immigrants, because when we forget history, we repeat it, right? That old maxim. So maybe just even asking these people, well, where did you come from? And where did your parents come from?
Right,
where did
and
your
those
grandparents
are the conversations where we can actually start
And yesterday I had the great pleasure, I'm going to do a little bit of Bragwell stuff here, I had the great pleasure of meeting Dr. Sutherland from Boise. She's teaching up in Boise, but she's a graduate of the same doctoral program that I am. And she was telling me that she had her students, I mean, it's an extremely conservative state, et cetera, but she had her students in their research class read an article that I had published, like in 2006, which was very specific in its title. And it was simple enough for them to read. And she said, you can't believe how much they loved that article, because they looked at immigrants and immigration in a whole different light, in ways that they never thought of before. So they really liked it. So sometimes even we can go to the literature, you know, as long as it's simple enough for people, you know, lay people to understand.
One thing that worked for us in this in Orange County is we have a board of supervisors of 5 individuals, and we went to the board of supervisors because, frankly, they don't want to acknowledge a problem because then they have to deal with it. Orange County, even though there's 22,000 children, because then they have to deal with it. But we had a health officer that came in that was very pro public health nursing, and so he invited them, an individual supervisor, to go out with a public health nurse into the community. Then it became a one-upmanship because, well, this supervisor went, well, now this supervisor went. So that opened a lot of eyes, because ultimately all 5 of them, and then there was other people that were asked to come from the community, and that got things moving a little bit because, one, they all had to go because the other one went. But it also actually showed them some of the actual, you know, this is not white Orange County anymore. Mm-hmm. And you have to acknowledge that and start addressing it. So, and we've made some inroads, but it was extremely difficult because they don't want to acknowledge.
Yeah. The couple last comments, I just want to make a couple comments on. And one is, we cannot make the assumption that because we're all public health providers that we all love everyone the same way. And we don't. People don't. People come with their prejudices and their biases. And so we've got our own, you know, social justice as a driving force in public health is is just sort of coming more into the fore. And there are people who aren't going to buy it, and people who do believe, you know, people from other countries, you know, the door should have been shut 50 yeah. years ago, and the rest of you stay out. And so, I mean, we meet that in the classroom. I mean, I see it operating in the classroom, and so, which then leads to, you know, how do you have conversations with people about, do you think that's the right way to be? I mean, I think hitting people in the face with what's wrong with you, you should be pro-immigrant, is never going to take, right? But it's those conversations about, so, let's talk about what, you know, there's unspoken fears, anxieties, you know, assumptions about other people who don't look like us or who don't act like us that we all have. And in some ways, those are some of the ways to open those conversations. And it'll, you know, it takes years. We're farther than we were. We've got a long way to go. So somebody, Becky. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm in Georgia, so I understand. And the problem that we're dealing with, or that I see, if you have public health, and I think a lot of public health nurses really do care about the immigrant population. There are some who don't, but that's okay. They're that way anyway. But there is a fear of bringing it to light, because then there will be a policy, and they're afraid that the policy is going to be more restrictive instead of more open. So I'm wondering if you all or anyone have any idea of how to deal with that. Because I really do see, like, it's like don't ask, don't tell. You know, just do. And it's all under the radar. It's sneaky care that I know I've done all my career, so
So they're afraid to bring up immigrant stuff because then they're afraid they're going to go, oh, wait, what have you people been doing? And we need to
provide care for them. They are.
I'm hoping.
Debbie?
I don't know how you deal with that. I mean, it's like operating in fear, which is, I instinctively think is wrong, but I also.
Yeah. I think one idea is that, about this language thing, and you have the language of your supervisors, and it probably will be very tainted in the ways you've described. And then you have other language that is language of rights and language of egalitarianism, and so who's going to supply that kind of language, because your supervisors aren't going to do it. And depending on your community, you could see whether you've got a council of churches or a human rights commission.
Yeah.
Many, many communities have a little human rights commission that's been laboring away.
Scary.
You know, God bless them. But supervisors can't insult them to their faces. And so if you have people who are brave enough to come and show up and say, here's the kind of language that we're talking about, at least that language gets placed out there, you know, have that at the beginning, and then the political strategy, if it works, is that then in a sense of embarrassment and confrontation against this, your supervisors have to go a little bit toward that sort of mom and apple pie language about fairness, which I understand many will object to, and that still shocks me. But you can have that language out there and move people a little bit toward that. So places like the Southern Poverty Law Center have language like that, the Human Rights Commissions have language like that, and even some evangelical churches who have sort of gone beyond some of the basic issues that have been fodder for some groups of churches to a more sort of ecological, one girl kind of thing. You know, there is language around there, and if you can get some brave person in your community to step out there and be willing to say that they're the spokesperson for that language, then you can kind of sit back, or your leaders can kind of sit back and say, oh, well, we really don't want to go that far, but we can go this far.
Oh, yeah, and I don't know if you have, like, a Healthy People Georgia, you know, I don't know
what's... Well, we need to have enough funding for this decade.
Oh.
Let's get this decade.
Nice to unite, you know.
Oh. Well, maybe the Healthy Georgia 2020, you could get on that. Because I know in Wisconsin, they're in the process of the Healthy Wisconsin 2020, but that might be another forum to see, are immigrants included in the document? What's the language around that? And then you're using that because it's a state if there's money for it.
There's no money. Well, the policy is no money.
November 2030, maybe, but that's really, I mean, that's because it's a state, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah. Yeah, but schools have to get involved, too. I'm Hispanic. And in nursing school, it was an advisor who came to me and said, you know, you should consider public health, as opposed, because I didn't really want to be in the hospital. I didn't see myself as a nurse practitioner, but I wanted to go back to school. And she's the one that fostered it. And when it came to the public health department, she's the one that was calling them and said, we've got this person who, you know, would be great for your program. And then when I got in, it was a mentor that helped me, because I'm a supervisor. And I'm the first ethnic supervisor in public health nursing in our county ever. But it took people to push me along the way as well. And now we're getting a lot more Hispanics that are coming in to serve those populations. But, you know, it started in the school. Mm-hmm. It was someone saying, you need to go back and get your bachelor's, you need to. Uh-huh. And at first I was a little bit offended, because it was always, I was just saying, I can go into any community because I look like the people that live there. And sometimes it was always that pushing, well, you're Hispanic, you need to do this, you need to do this. And I was like, you know what? I'm tired of being Hispanic.
Yeah.
But, you know, bottom line is, you got to find those people and move them along. And it was through school. It was through Cal State Long Beach that really, an advisor there that really pushed you. And there.
I have a number of different observations, and I think this is very much a multi-pronged problem. You know, there's many different levels of public policy. There right now, there's federal policy. It's going to come back in 2009 or 2010. There's a state-by-state struggle, and different states are very different. I mean, the South is different from the Midwest, and very different political traditions. But there is a concerted campaign to increase restrictive laws at state levels. But people in the health sector have a lot of credibility in those debates. It's also important to look for non-traditional allies, like the National Roofing Contractors Association and the Gardeners Association.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We don't have exploitable labor forces, but frankly, at this moment, are supportive of pro-immigration policies. Mm-hmm. There's individual hospital districts, counties, cities, hospital districts, public health districts. Every one of them is a public policy domain. In addition, there's de facto policy at the level of the nurses and receptionists and other people. There's a classic book called Street Level Bureaucracy, which is about the frontal face of how you ration services when services are scarce, and the importance of moral concepts. They don't talk about the language, but it's very easy to see that the language of the moralization has to do with who deserves to get these rationed resources and who doesn't. And there's more recent book from University of Michigan Press that's through Little Yarmouth, but I can't remember the name of it. University of Michigan Press has a more recent book on the subject of street level bureaucrats, but the original one is called Street Level Bureaucracy, and it's a classic. And so that's a great deal of what gets done in the health system, is categorizing people and rationing things.
Right.
And it makes a great deal of difference how that's done, by whom and what their consciousness is. Likewise, I think it's very important to think of some very crude cost-benefit arguments, because I'm very involved with public policy directly and nationally and in the state of Texas. I think things that are, to me personally, quite unacceptable sorts of cost-benefit arguments are very powerful, because part of the thing that's driving restriction of health care in immigration, against immigrants of various different types of statuses, is the healthcare crisis, the healthcare cost crisis. And so let's say that impacts a public hospital. And so in order to be able to argue back against that, you have to make, for example, the argument of primary care and preventive care and chronic care as opposed to emergency care, acute care. And the numbers are quite strong. And it's a crude argument, and I'm not real crazy about that, counting people as dollars, but it makes a huge difference. So, I think that this is a very multidimensional struggle that we're involved with. But people who are in the healthcare area have professional credibility, and you need to absolutely be courageous in confronting and say, look, we're out there on the front lines. This is how you take care of people. And if you don't do it, all these terrible things are going to happen.
We're at 10 o'clock. Thank you all for coming. Thank you very much.